Let's get kinky. You're listening to the Funny Dom Podcast.
Hi, folks. Welcome to this week's show. Thanks for joining me. This week, we'll have some more listener questions and some good topics, and we'll have our continued reading. I may also have a little bonus segment at the end of the show, so stay tuned for that. And I'd like to thank all of my Patreon supporters, my very first audience for this podcast. Next week's episode, we will be starting to distribute these onto Spotify and other platforms. So Patreon will remain the exclusive pre-release, as well as having all the other Funny Dom content. Episodes will go there first, and then they will go onto the other podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts, etc. Also next week, episode will feature a bit of insight into a kink party, a kink event. I'll be going to a big event with Bunny. It'll be her first event of that type, and we're very excited about it. I will be having her on a leashed for some of the time, and I'll definitely be putting her at my feet whenever I can. It'll be a lot of fun. So, we'll have a bit of an insight into that, and maybe even a little kind of gonzo journalist-style recording from the field of that event. It'll be very exciting. And from the 24th of October, we will be beginning to distribute the Funny Dom Podcast onto podcast platforms for a wider audience. So you heard it here. That's the big announcement. Let's get to some questions.
Hello, sir. I hope you're having a wonderful day. I'm just wondering about tasks. I really like the idea of being assigned tasks. Whether that be, something daily or weekly, or when we're out. So that would be, really interesting to hear your thoughts on that. I'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Bye.
I love giving my sub a task or a protocol. I think these things are not overlooked, but they may be misunderstood for how powerful they are. I just did my most recent meme was a cute one with a real meaning behind it, showing a little critter, bundled up and cozy, and the blanket and the coziness was the kind of metaphor for dominance, expectations and tasks. It's really an extension of not just the discipline and order and management, but it is care. So it's a way of giving a structure to a feeling, which is that feeling of being held, of being within your dominance grasp, So I think they are an essential part of a dynamic, especially if you are not living together. Now, if you're living together, they should still be used. It's such a needed thing, but they're so functional for when you're apart. So if you're going away from your partner or you're not seeing them for days or weeks, having a protocol, which an easy way to think of a protocol is just an ongoing task. It's an expectation that is set as ongoing in some way. And a task might be as simple as on this day, you will have a early night because I know that you've got an early morning. So that can be also just a very simple self-care can be a task, but that's a way of caring for your submissive, is to kind of weaponize their own self-care to really enforce that. So it's not just an exercise of your power over them, which is also fine. It is actually helping them help themselves, and that's what the dynamic should do. So I think that a task or a protocol is so functional, and they're so great. They can do so many things. I once had a protocol for a date of, which is like a negotiated thing for once we're in this venue, this protocol is in place, which is these hand signals will be obeyed, or once we're there, you are not to go to the bathroom without permission. So that's a protocol for once we're out. We're in public, you require my permission to go to the bar without me, or to go to the bathroom, to basically go somewhere on your own, is something that you cannot do without my permission. And that is, that should feel, it should not feel controlling in a negative way. It should feel looked after. It should feel like care, and it should feel like discipline and safety and protectiveness. That's what it should be. They can also just be more playful. So when we are in a certain an event, you know, we're going to be in dynamic. So you are only to sit on the floor at my feet. You are not allowed furniture, or you will be furniture. So if I sit down, the protocol will be you're expected to kneel in front of me and then get on hands and knees, and you will be a footstool without my even requesting it or making any kind of signal. That is an expectation, that is a protocol. So there's so many things that they can do, and I think creatively it's a great area for a dominant to flex and to learn and to explore and to enjoy their own power, their own ability to affect and to exercise and responsibility, because knowing that you can create a task and a protocol, and that the submissive being, your submissive, will want to do their best to carry that out. And so there's a great responsibility in that literal power to make it good for them, to have it be a thing that is satisfying for you at the same time as being good for them, that actually gives them what they want and need as well as what you want and need. And that is a big part of the satisfaction and the pride of being a good dominant, is to carry those things out, to create those things and then give them to your submissive. So it's also a lot of what I do dynamically with the work I do with the people I work with, is by using protocols and task structure to create accountability. And it's very powerful. So I hope that helped. Thanks for the question.
The Funny Dom. Thanks for all you do, man. I really appreciate all the content and info you put out. I really value it. My question is, have you ever been the submissive in a scene? Why or why not, and how did it go? I've read a lot of information about Doms finding a lot of value in that, or needing to do that so that they're not, you know, asking a submissive to do something they're not willing to do, or really even just learning things, seeing what it's like on the other side, you know, getting value out of it that way. So that's my question. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question. Have I been a submissive? No. So I have bottomed in rope. I have done rope play and done a little bit of rope scene as a bottom, which definitely is a kind of submission. But being a submissive, I don't think you can do, if you identify as a dominant and that is very largely your identity, you can't just be something else. So you can experience other things, and you can definitely experience practices, especially if your intention is further awareness. I'm all for that. The point of view of like trying something so that you know more about it to help you deliver that to another is like, it's just based on empathy. Like, that's absolutely a good idea. But the kind of, it's a fallacy out there about like, oh, you should do that before you expect someone else to do it. I'm like, that's weird. It's not an expectation of someone to be a submissive. They are a submissive. Like, you're giving them that space to be themselves. If you're not a submissive, then you can't give yourself, there's no need for you to give yourself that space. Like, it's more about just safety and awareness. So you should experience things that you can comfortably experience for the tangible sensation. It's good to know what rope feels like if you're learning rope. If you are going to top or be a rigger or a dominant that uses rope, then knowing what it feels like to be bound, knowing what ties feel like, it's just smart. It just makes sense. It's also a good grounding experience. That's what I got out of it, was I felt the ability to just surrender and relax. And I do have that need sometimes. So it is a kind of slight switchiness where I can kind of let go and reground and recharge. And I get that same kind of sensation from the balancing practices that I have day to day, whether that's exercise or just meditation. So I feel it's there's a little bit of misunderstanding and pressure. People put dominance or people at top in to like, you should do that before you have others do it. And they go, you can't be something that you're not. But you can certainly play with things and experience things that you intend to have others experience via your delivery. And thanks for those questions, folks. Remember, you can always send in a voice message question to me on my Instagram at the Funny Dom Returns, or very soon I think you'll be able to do it through the either through the Spotify or the Anchor page. So look out for that. Another thing that happened this week that I just thought about talking about, and I think I will, is the two very different experiences this week where in the last couple of days I had a new subscriber that I started working with express a really like kind, positive like resonance of recognizing what I want to do here and what I'm doing here. And I struggled to respond to it because it was so positive and kind. And she wasn't looking for anything back. She was just wanted to express that she recognized that I was doing something good and intending something good. And she was appreciating the space that I was making and that she was now able to connect with and be a part of. And it was very beautiful. And it made me kind of appreciate what I'm doing, and whether it's just on the Instagram with just, you know, memes, and through the Patreon and talking to people and writing, you know, kink guides and content and some fun stuff, and then actually like working with people and all the kind of peer support and the little bit of coaching stuff, and now this podcast as well. And yeah, it kind of gave me a little moment of gratitude to realize, oh wow, this has all happened in the past few years, and it really is a bit of a dream. And yeah, I had a lot of gratitude for it. And then within that day, I think within that 24 hours, another supporter, just on the page, another like a follower who had been following the page for quite some time and been very supportive, just messaged me out of the blue to kind of let me know that herself and I think some other people that had talked to her found my some of my content or my my promotion of my content alienating and that it brought into question my authenticity, which, you know, I really didn't understand and really put me on quite a back foot and quite defensive, and I felt quite hurt by that, really. And it was a bit jarring after that positive experience. And I just wanted to express that and I suppose kind of point out like the oddness of being in this space and being a kind of semi-niche public persona where people can give you this kind of reaction and you can maybe invest too much in that, in hearing that, and then someone else give you what feels like it doesn't feel constructive or positive at all. It feels quite negative and narrow-minded and limiting. And both can affect me, you know. Both are very difficult to just brush off, and I think that's a struggle. And in trying to hear both, I really appreciate what all of you have supported me to build, and I don't take it for granted, and I hope that the fact that I am building this and that I do promote my subscription and you know, the podcast and all the things, I hope that doesn't alienate anyone, and I hope that doesn't bring into question any authenticity, and people see it as just exactly what it is, just trying to encourage people to subscribe and support so that I can spend more time here and put more time and energy into this. So yep. thanks for listening to my rant.
To support this space and to get access to TFD's exclusive guides to kink, spicy content and more, check out his Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefunnydom.
As I mentioned earlier, there's a little bit of a bonus segment this week. Since next week, me and Bunny and I will be attending a big kink event, I wanted to include this week, for any listeners that that missed it or may not have heard, a little audio recollection I did the morning after, the night before of our first event together. We went along to a local shibari night and had some cocktails and had some very dynamic times together afterwards. So I hope you enjoy this as a little preview of what we may be enjoying next week. I'm just lying in bed in the room the morning after the night before, and while the sun is still coming up and I'm looking at Melbourne wake up, I thought I'd tell you about last night. So it was a shibari and cocktails night that's held every month. I've been to many at this point, but last night was Bunny's first event and first time to that, so it was very special. So I got a place for us to stay in the city. You may have seen the view. That's what I'm looking at right now. And we met there and got ready, and I actually managed to not strip her while she was getting dressed, as definitely could have happened. But we had a nice time just kind of settling in and looking at the nice view of the city, and then got ready and wandered down to the bar. It's it's held in a nice vibey kind of good atmosphere downstairs kind of cocktail bar in the city. And when we got there and got a drink, I think we both had, I had a glass of wine, and Bunny had a cocktail, and we found a little seat and just got settled in. I think she was a little bit nervous, but it was very calm, chatty, like very relaxed kind of atmosphere. So, and we saw two pairs, two ties. So you have like a little series of usually duos, couples tying, and it'll be different gender, different dynamics. And the first one was very kind of slow. It was a rigger and model, very kind of connected. Definitely seemed like they were a couple. They tied together a lot. It was very slow and intense and intimate. Everyone got very hushy quiet and watched, and very slow burny. It was nice. And we watched that, and then we got another drink, and we were around the back. So I said, like, for the next one, let's try and get right in the kind of around the corner front, so we'll sit in. And I saw a former partner of mine there. It was her first time as well. So we all said hi. She was very brave. She'd gone there on her own. She was going with a friend, but her friend wasn't feeling well, so she went on her own. So big claps there. And we told her we were going to go sit in front. I said, come and sit with us if you want to have a better view, and if that's, you know, if that feels more comfortable, come and hang out a little bit. So she did. So we went and sat in front, and she came and joined us. So that felt nice. And the next tie was one of the kind of organizers of the event, one of the curators. Really, really good rigger. Really good teachers, and is very vibey. And yeah, I really like watching his stuff. And I think the model was her first time, I think, because they were kind of introducing her in the online beforehand. So it was a really good connection.
really good tie. That was several kind of positions. He made her into a few different shapes, did full suspension, partial. There was a bit of hair tying, which was funny. And yeah, it was really good. Really, really, really good. So by then it was already around 10 o'clock. And Bunny had worked the next morning, and she knew that I was going to take her back to the room to play, so we were both kind of keeping an eye on the time. So I said we could hang around. I think the next tie, I knew who was tying next, and it was a female rigger who was brilliant. I said, it's going to be really good, but yeah, it's getting a bit late, so we should probably go now. And Bunny agreed. So we came back to the room and got a little bit settled in. I put her in front of a standing mirror just for a little bit of kind of inspection and holding. And then we took her into the bedroom, the bed that I'm lying on now, where I had some toys laid out in case I wanted to use them. I knew our time was limited, so I did want to do some impact though. So I did put her on the bed and strip her and told her that she had some smacks owed because she had stayed up past her bedtime. And she argued over whether it was 16 strikes or 18. And I was quite certain it was 18. She was saying, no, Daddy, no, it's 16, 16. I said, if you're wrong, I'm going to plus 10. And she said, no, it was 16. It was 16, you're wrong, it's not 18. I said, I'm going to check. So I checked our messages and found where she'd stayed up 18 minutes past her bedtime. And she kept protesting. And I told her to shush and just turned her over and picked her up by the hips. And I told her I'd give her half the 28 strikes with the soft paddle that I brought and the other half with the long flogger. But for the flogger strikes, I was going to pull her underwear down, which she murmured at in protest a little bit because she knew that mean I might give her a few lashes on her pussy. So I told her to shush again and to keep her hips up, showing Daddy her cheeks. So I gave her her smacks, pulled her nice white underwear down, gave her her flogs, teased her pussy with the flogger quite a bit until she was whimpering a little, and gave her some hand smacks and checked to see how wet she was. And then I grabbed her and picked her up and pushed her against the window so she could watch the view while I used her pussy. And then things continued a little bit. It was a very nice night.
I hope you enjoyed that little flashback to that recollection. And I wonder what next week we'll have to tell you. And I hope you'll enjoy joining us for that. Now it's time for our continued reading segment. Last week I made the first steps into the big adventure that is Outlander. So we're going to continue with that right now and get ready for some fireplace style reading and possibly some more of my questionable Scottish accent. So let's begin.
You're listening to the Funny Dom Podcast.
In the event, there were no kilt wearers loitering about the town or patronising the shops. There were a number of other people there, though, mostly housewives of the Mrs. Bard type, doing their daily shopping. They were garrulous and gossipy, and their solid tweedy presences filled the shops with a cosy warmth, a buttress against the cold mist of the morning outdoors. With as yet no house of my own to keep, I had little that needed buying. There was little to buy, yet in truth, supplies were still short, but enjoyed myself in browsing among the sparse shelves of the shops. My gaze lingered on a shop window containing a scattering of household goods, embroidered tea cloths, a set of jug and glasses, a stack of homely pie tins, and a set of three vases. I had never owned a vase in my life. During the war years, I had, of course, lived in the nurses' quarters, first at Pembroke Hospital, later at the field station in France. But even before that, we had lived nowhere long enough to justify the purchase of such an item. Had I had such a thing, I reflected, Uncle Lamb would have filled it with potsherds long before I could have gotten near it with a bunch of daisies. Quinton Lambert Beauchamp Q, to his archaeological students and his friends, Dr. Beauchamp to the scholarly circles in which he moved and lectured and had his being, but always Uncle Lamb to me. My father's only brother and my only living relative, he had been landed with me, age 5, when my parents were killed in a car crash. Poised for a trip to the Middle East at the time, he had paused in his preparations long enough to make the funeral arrangements, dispose of my parents' estates and enrol me in a proper girls' boarding school, which I had flatly refused to attend. Faced with the necessity of prying my chubby fingers off the car's door handle and dragging me by the heels up the steps of the school, Uncle Lamb, who hated personal conflict of any kind, had sighed in exasperation, then finally shrugged and tossed his better judgment out of the window along with my newly purchased round straw boater. "Ruddy thing," he muttered, seeing it rolling merrily away in the rearview mirror as we roared down the drive in high gear. Always loathed hats on women anyway, he had glanced down at me, fixing me with a fierce glare. "One thing," he said in awful tones, "you are not to play dolls with my Persian grave figures. Anything else, but not that. Is that clear?" I had nodded, content, and had gone with him to the Middle East, to South America, to dozens of study sites throughout the world, had learned to read and write from the drafts of journal articles, to dig latrines and boil water, and to do a number of other things not suitable for a young lady of gentle birth, until I met the handsome, dark-haired historian who came to consult Uncle Lamb on a point of French philosophy as it related to Egyptian religious practice. Even after our marriage, Frank and I led the nomadic life of junior faculty, divided between continental conferences and temporary flats, until the outbreak of war had sent him to officers' training and the intelligence unit at MI6, and me to nurses' training. Though we had been married nearly 8 years, the new house in Oxford would be our first real home. Tucking my handbag firmly under my arm, I marched into the shop and bought the vases. I met Frank at the crossing of the High Street and the Gerside Road, and we turned up it together. He raised his eyebrows at my purchases. "Vases," he smiled. "Wonderful. Perhaps now you'll stop putting flowers in my books." "They aren't flowers, they're specimens, and it was you who suggested I take up botany." "To occupy my mind, now that I've no nursing to do," I reminded him. "True," he nodded good-humouredly, "but I didn't realise I'd have bits of greenery dropping out into my lap every time I opened a reference. What was that horrible crumbly brown stuff you put in Tuscan banks?" "Comfrey, good for hemorrhoids." "Preparing for my imminent old age, are you? Well, how very thoughtful of you, Claire." We had promised to drop in on the Carsons around the corner. We pushed through the gate laughing, and Frank stood back to let me go first up the narrow front steps. Suddenly he caught my arm. "Look out. You don't want to step in it." I lifted my foot gingerly over a large brownish-red stain on the top step. "How odd," I said. "Mrs. Carson scrubs the steps down every morning. I've seen her. What do you suppose that can be?" Frank leaned over the step, sniffing delicately. "Offhand, I should say that it's blood." "Blood?" I took a step back into the entryway. "Whose?" I glanced nervously into the house. "Do you suppose the Carsons have had an accident of some kind? I couldn't imagine our tidy neighbours leaving bloodstains to dry on their doorstep unless some major catastrophe had occurred, and wondered just for a moment whether the parlour might be harbouring a crazed axe murderer, even now preparing to spring out on us with a spine-chilling shriek." Frank shook his head. He stood on tiptoe to peer over the hedge into the next garden. "I shouldn't think so. There's a stain like it on the Collins' doorstep as well. Really? I drew closer to Frank, both to see over the hedge and for moral support. The Highlands hardly seemed a likely spot for a mass murderer, but then I doubted such persons used any sort of logical criteria when picking their sites. That's rather disagreeable, I observed. There was no sign of life from the next residence. What do you suppose has happened? Frank frowned, thinking, and then slapped his hand briefly against his trouser leg in inspiration. I think I know. Wait here a moment. He darted out to the gate and set off down the road at a trot, leaving me stranded on the edge of the doorstep. He was back shortly, beaming with confirmation. Yes, that's it. It must be. Every house in the row has it. Had what? A visit from a homicidal maniac? I spoke a bit sharply, still nervous at having been abruptly abandoned with nothing but a large bloodstain for company. Frank laughed. No, a ritual sacrifice. Fascinating. He was down on his hands and knees in the grass, peering interestedly at the stain. This hardly sounded better than a homicidal maniac. I squatted beside him, wrinkling my nose at the smell. It was early for flies, but a horde of tiny, voracious Highland midges circled the stain. What do you mean, ritual sacrifice? I demanded. Mrs. Carson's a good churchgoer, and so are all the neighbours. This isn't Druid's Hill or anything, you know. He stood, brushing grass ends from his trousers. That's all you know, my girl, he said. There's no place on earth with more of the old superstitions and magic mixed into its daily life than the Scottish Highlands. Church or no church, Mrs. Carson believes in the old folk, and so do all the neighbours. He pointed at the stain with one neatly polished toe. The blood of a black cock, he explained, looking pleased. The houses are new, you see, prefabs. I looked at him coldly. If you are under the impression that that explains everything, think again. What difference does it make how old the houses are, and where on earth is everybody? Down at the pub, I should expect. Let's go along and see, shall we? Taking my arm, he steered me out of the gate and we set off down the Gearside Road. In the old days, he explained as we went, and not so long ago either, when a house was built, it was customary to kill something and bury it under the foundation, as a propitiation to the local earth spirits, you know. He shall lay the foundations thereof in his firstborn, and in his youngest son shall he set up the gates of it. Old as the hills. I shuddered at the quotation. In that case, I suppose it's quite modern and enlightened of them to be using chickens instead. You mean, since the houses are fairly new, nothing was buried under them, and the inhabitants are now remedying the omission? Yes, exactly. Frank seemed pleased with my progress and patted me on the back. A little bit of a good girl move there, Frank. According to the minister, many of the local folk thought the war was due in part to people turning away from their roots and omitting to take proper precautions, such as burying a sacrifice under the foundation, that is, or burning fishes' bones on the hearth. Except haddocks, of course, he added, happily distracted. You never burn a haddock's bones, did you know? Or you'll never catch another. Always bury the bones of a haddock instead. I'll bear it in mind, I said. Tell me what you do in order to never see another herring, and I'll do it forthwith. He shook his head, absorbed in one of his feats of memory, those brief periods of scholastic rapture where he lost touch with the world around him, absorbed completely in conjuring up knowledge from all its sources. I don't know about herring, he said absently. For mice, though, you hang bunches of trembling jock about. Trembling jock in the hoose, and you'll ne'er see a moose, you know. Bodies under the foundation, though, that's where a lot of the old local ghosts come from. You know Mount Gerard, the big house at the end of High Street? There's a ghost there, a workman on the house, who was killed as a sacrifice for the foundation. It was sometime in the 18th century. That's really fairly recent, he nodded thoughtfully. The story goes that by order of the house's owner, one wall was built up first, then a stone block was dropped from the top of it onto one of the workmen. Presumably, a dislikable fellow was chosen for the sacrifice, and he was buried then in the cellar, and the rest of the house built up over him. He haunts the cellar where he was killed, except on the anniversary of his death and the four old days. Old days? The ancient feasts, he explained, still lost in his mental notes. Hogmanay, A, that's New Year's Eve, Midsummer Day, Beltan, and All Hallows. Druids, Beaker Folk, Early Picts, everybody kept the sun feasts and the fire feasts, so far as we know. Anyway, ghosts are freed on the holy days, and can wander about at will, to do harm or good as they please. He rubbed his chin thoughtfully. It's getting on for Beltan. The Celtic May Day Festival. Best keep an eye out next time you pass the kirkyard. His eyes twinkled, and I realised the trance had ended. I laughed. Are there a number of famous local ghosts, then? He shrugged. Don't know. We'll ask Mr. Wakefield. Shall we, next time we see him? We saw Mr. Wakefield that evening, in fact. He, along with most of the other inhabitants of the neighbourhood, was in the hotel lounge, having a lemonade in celebration of the house's new sanctification. He seemed rather embarrassed at being caught in the act of condoning a paganism, as it were, but brushed it off as merely a local observance with historical colour, like the wearing of the green. Really rather fascinating, you know, he confided, and I recognised with an internal sigh the song of the scholar, as identifying a sound of the call of the cuckoo. Harking to the sound of a kindred spirit, Frank at once settled down to the mating dance of academy, and they were soon neck-deep in archetypes and the parallels between ancient superstitions and modern religions. I snagged a passing waitress and secured a couple of cups of tea. Knowing from experience how difficult it was to distract Frank's attention from this sort of discussion, I simply picked up his hand, wrapped his fingers about the handle of the cup, and left him to his own devices. I found our landlady, Mrs. Bard, on a love seat near the window, sharing a companionable plate of digestive biscuits with an elderly man, whom she introduced to me as Mr. Crook. "This is the man I tell you about, Mrs. Randall," she said, eyes bright with the stimulation of company. "The one as knows about plants of sorts." "Mrs. Randall's very much interested in the wee plants," she confided to her companion, who inclined his head in a combination of politeness and deafness. "Presses them in books and such." "Do you indeed?" Mr. Crook asked, one tufted white brow raised in interest. "I've some presses, real ones, mind, for plants and such. Had them from my nephew when he came up from university over the holiday. He brought them for me, and I'd not the heart to tell him I never used such things. Hangin's what's wanted for herbs, you ken? Or maybe to be dried on a frame and put in a bit of a gauze bag or a jar. But why ever you'd be after squashing the wee things flat, I've no idea." "Well, to look at, maybe," Mrs. Bard interjected kindly. "Mrs. Randall's made some lovely bits of wood, anemone, and violets, same as you would put in a frame and hang on the wall like." "Oomph." Mr. Crook's face seemed to be admitting a dubious possibility to this suggestion. "Well, if they're of any use to ye, missus, you can have the presses and welcome. I did no wish to be throwing them away, but I must say I've no use for them." I assured Mr. Crook that I would be delighted to make use of the plant presses, and still more delighted if he would show me where some of the rarer plants in the area could be found. He eyed me sharply for a moment, head to one side like an elderly kestrel, but appeared finally to decide that my interest was genuine, and we fixed it up that I should meet him in the morning for a tour of the local shrubbery. Frank, I knew, meant to spend the morning consulting records in the town hall, and I was pleased to have an excuse not to accompany him. One record was much like another, so far as I was concerned. Soon after this, Frank prized himself away from the minister, and we walked home in company with Mrs. Bard. I was reluctant to mention the cock's blood we had seen on the doorsteps myself, but Frank suffered from no such reticence, and questioned her eagerly as to the background of the custom. "I suppose it's quite old, then," he asked, swishing a stick along through the roadside weeds. "Fat hen and cinquefoil were green in the ditches, and I could see the buds of sweet broom just starting to show." "Och, aye," Mrs. Bard waddled along at a brisk pace, asking no quarter from our younger limbs. "Older than anyone knows, Mr. Randall, even back before the days of the giants." "Giants?" I asked. "Aye, Fionn and Fionn ye ken." "Gaelic folk tales," Frank remarked with interest. "Heroes, you know, probably from Norse roots. There's a lot of the Norse influence around here, and all the way up the coast to the west. Some of the place names are Norse, you know, not Gaelic at all." I rolled my eyes, sensing another outburst, but Mrs. Bard smiled kindly and encouraged him, saying that was true then, She'd been up to the north and seen the two brothers stone, and that was Norse, wasn't it? The Norsemen came down on the coast hundreds of times between AD 500 and 1300 or so, Frank said, looking dreamily at the horizon, seeing dragon ships in the windswept cloud. Vikings, you know, and they brought a lot of their own myths along. It's a good country for myths. Things seem to take root here. This I could believe. Twilight was coming on, and so was a storm. In the eerie light beneath the clouds, even the thoroughly modern houses along the road looked as ancient and sinister as the weathered Pictish stone that stood 100 feet away, guarding the crossroads it had marked for 1,000 years. It seemed like a good night to be inside with the shutters fastened. Rather than staying cosily in Mrs. Bard's parlour to be entertained by stereopticon views of Perth, though, Frank chose to keep his appointment for sherry with Mr. Barnbridge, a solicitor with an interest in local historical records. Bearing in mind my earlier encounter with Mr. Barnbridge, I elected to stay at home. "Try to come back before the storm breaks," I said, kissing Frank goodbye, "and give my regards to Mr. Barnbridge." Yes, of course," carefully not meeting my eye. Frank shrugged into his overcoat and left, collecting an umbrella from the stand by the door. I closed the door after him, but left it on the latch so he could get back in. I wandered back towards the parlour, reflecting that Frank would doubtless pretend that he didn't have a wife, a pretense in which Mr. Bainbridge would cheerfully join, not that I could blame him particularly. At first, everything had gone quite well on our visit to Mr. Bainbridge's home the afternoon before. I had been demure, genteel, intelligent but self-effacing, well-groomed and quietly dressed, everything the perfect Don's wife should be, until the tea was served. I now turned my right hand over, ruefully examining the large blister that ran across the bases of all four fingers. After all, it was not my fault that Mr. Bainbridge, a widower, made do with a cheap tin teapot instead of a proper crockery one, nor that the solicitor, seeking to be polite, had asked me to pour, nor that the potholder he provided me with had a worn patch that allowed the red-hot handle of the teapot to come into direct contact with my hand when I picked it up. No, I decided. Dropping the teapot was a perfectly normal reaction. Dropping it on Mr. Bainbridge's carpet was merely an accident of placement. I had to drop it somewhere. It was my exclaiming, "Bloody fucking hell," in a voice that topped Mr. Bainbridge's heart cry that made Frank glare at me across the scones. Once he recovered from the shock, Mr. Bainbridge had been quite gallant, fussing about my hand and ignoring Frank's attempts to excuse my language on grounds that I had been stationed in a field hospital for the better part of 2 years. I'm afraid my wife picked up a number of colourful expressions from the Yanks and such, Frank offered with a nervous smile. True, I said, gritting my teeth as I wrapped a water-soaked napkin about my hand. Men tend to be very colourful when you're picking shrapnel out of them. Mr. Bainbridge had tactfully tried to distract the conversation onto neutral historical ground by saying that he had always been interested in the variations of what was considered profane speech through the ages. There was Gorblimey, for example, a recent corruption of the oath God blind me. Yes, of course, said Frank, gratefully accepting the diversion. No sugar, thank you, Claire. What about gadzooks? The gad part is quite clear, of course, but the zook? Well, you know, the solicitor interjected, I've sometimes thought it might be a corruption of the old Scots word, in fact, uke, meaning itch. That would make sense, wouldn't it? Frank nodded, letting his unscholarly forelock fall across his forehead. He pushed it back automatically. Interesting, he said, the whole evolution of profanity. Yes, and it's still going on, I said, carefully picking up a lump of sugar with the tongs. Oh, said Mr. Bainbridge politely, did you encounter some interesting variations during your war experience? Oh, yes, I said. My favourite was when I picked up from a Yank, man named Williamson from New York, I believe. He said it every time I changed his dressing. What was it? Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, I said, and dropped the sugar lump neatly and deliberately into Frank's cup. After a peaceful and not unpleasant sit with Mrs. Bard, I made my way upstairs to ready myself before Frank came home. I knew his limit with sherry was 2 glasses, so I expected him back soon. The wind was rising, and the very air of the bedroom was prickly with electricity. I drew the brush through my hair, making the curls snap with static and spring into knots with furious tangles. My hair would have to do without its 100 strokes tonight, I thought. Oh, 100 strokes. I decided. I would settle for brushing my teeth in this sort of weather. Strands of hair adhered stickily to my cheeks, clinging stubbornly as I tried to smooth them back. No water in the ewer. Frank had used it, tidying himself before setting out for his meeting with Mr. Bainbridge, and I had not bothered to refill it from the bathroom tap. I picked up the bottle of Le Hue Bleu and poured a generous puddle into the palm of my hand. Rubbing my hands briskly together before the scent could evaporate, I smoothed them rapidly through my hair. I poured another dollop onto my hairbrush and swept the curls back behind my ears with it. Well, that was rather better, I thought, turning my head from side to side to examine the results in the speckled-looking glass. The moisture had dissipated the static electricity in my hair so that it floated in heavy, shining waves about my face, and the evaporating alcohol had left behind a very pleasant scent. Frank would like that, I thought. Le Hue Bleu was his favourite. There was a sudden flash close at hand, with the crash of thunder following hard on its heels, and all the lights went out. Cursing under my breath, I groped in the drawers. Somewhere I had seen candles and matches. Power failure was so frequent an occurrence in the Highlands that candles were a necessary furnishing for all inn and hotel rooms. I had seen them even in the Royal Edinburgh, where they were scented with honeysuckle and elegantly presented in frosted glass holders with shimmering pendants. Mrs. Bard's candles were far more utilitarian, plain white household candles, but there were a lot of them, and 3 boxes of matches as well. I was not inclined to be fussy over style at a time like this. I fitted a candle to the blue ceramic holder on the dressing table by the light of the next flash, then moved about the room lighting others, till the whole room was filled with a soft, wavering radiance. Very romantic, I thought, and with some presence of mind I pressed down the light switch so that a sudden return of power shouldn't ruin the mood at some inopportune moment. The candles had burned no more than half an inch when the door opened and Frank blew in, literally for the draught that followed him up the stairs and extinguished 3 of the candles. The door closed behind with a bang that blew out 2 more, and he peered into the sudden gloom, pushing a hand through his dishevelled hair. I got up and relit the candles, making mild remarks about his abrupt methods of entering rooms. It was only when I had finished and turned to ask him whether he'd like a drink that I saw he was looking rather white and unsettled. "What's the matter?" I said. "Seen a ghost?" "Well, you know," he said slowly, "I'm not at all sure that I haven't." Absent-mindedly, he picked up my hairbrush and raised it to tidy his hair, when a sudden whiff of Le Hue Bleu reached his nostrils. He wrinkled his nose and set it down again, settling for the attentions of his pocket comb instead. I glanced through the window, where the lime trees were lashing to and fro like flails. It occurred to me that we ought perhaps to close our shutters, though the carry-on outside was rather exciting to watch. "Bit blustery for a ghost, I'd think," I said. "Don't they like quiet, misty evenings in graveyards?" Frank laughed a bit sheepishly. "Well, I dare say it's only Bainbridge's stories, plus a bit more of his sherry, than I really meant to have. Nothing at all, probably." Now I was curious. "What exactly did you see?" I asked, settling myself on the dressing table seat. I motioned to the whiskey bottle with a half-lifted brow, and Frank went at once to pour a couple of drinks. "Well, only a man, really," he began, measuring out a tot for himself and 2 for me. "Standing down in the road outside." "What, outside this house?" I laughed. "Must have been a ghost, then. I can't imagine any living person standing about on a night like this." Frank tilted the ewer over his glass, then looked accusingly at me when no water came out. "Don't look at me," I said. "You used up all the water." "I don't mind it neat, though," I took a sip in illustration. Frank looked as though he were tempted to nip down to the bathroom for water, but abandoned the idea and went on with his story, sipping cautiously as though his glass contained vitriol rather than the most expensive product of the local illicit stills. Yes, he was down at the edge of the garden, on this side, standing by the hedge, I thought. He hesitated, looking down at his glass. I rather thought he was looking up at your window. My window? How extraordinary. I couldn't repress a mild shiver and went across to fasten the shutters, though it seemed a bit late for that. Frank followed me across the room, still talking. Yes, I could see you myself from below. You were brushing your hair and cursing a bit because it was standing on end. In that case, the fellow was probably enjoying a good laugh, I said tartly. Frank shook his head, though he smiled and smoothed his hands over my hair. No, he wasn't laughing. In fact, he seemed terribly unhappy about something. Not that I could see his face. Well, just something about the way he stood. I came up behind him, and when he didn't move, I asked politely if I could help him with something. He acted at first as though he didn't hear me, and I thought perhaps he didn't over the noise of the wind, so I repeated myself, and I reached out to tap his shoulder to get his attention, you know. But before I could touch him, he whirled suddenly around and pushed past me and walked off down the road. Sounds a bit rude, but not very ghostly, I observed, draining my glass. What did he look like? Big chap, said Frank, frowning in recollection, and a Scot, in complete Highland rigout, complete to sporran, and the most beautiful running stag brooch on his plaid. I wanted to ask where he'd got it from, but he was off before I could. I went to the chest of drawers and poured another drink. Well, not so unusual an appearance. For these parts, surely. I've seen men dressed like that in the village now and then. No, Frank sounded doubtful. No, it wasn't his dress that was odd. But when he pushed past me, I could swear he was close enough that I should have felt him brush my sleeve, but I didn't. And I was intrigued enough to turn round and watch him as he walked away. He walked down the Gearside Road, but when he'd almost reached the corner, he disappeared. That's when I began to feel a bit cold down the backbone. Perhaps your attention was distracted for a second, and he just stepped aside into the shadows, I suggested. There are a lot of trees down near that corner. I could swear I didn't take my eyes off him for a moment, muttered Frank. He looked up suddenly. I know. I remember now why I thought he was so odd, though I didn't realise it at the time. What? I was getting a bit tired of the ghost and wanted to go on to more interesting matters, such as bed. The wind was cutting up like billy-o. But his drapes, his kilt, his plaid, they didn't move at all, except to the stir of his walking. We stared at each other. Well, that is a bit spooky. Frank shrugged and smiled, suddenly dismissing it. At least I'll have something to tell the minister next time I see him. Perhaps it's a well-known local ghost and he can give me his gory history. He glanced at his watch. But now I'd say it's bedtime. So it is, I murmured. I watched him in the mirror as he removed his shirt and reached for a hanger. Suddenly he paused in mid-button. Did you have many Scots in your charge, Claire? He asked abruptly. At the field hospital or at Pembroke? Of course, I replied, somewhat puzzled. There were quite a few of the Seaforths and Camerons through the field hospital at Eamons. And then a bit later, at Cane, we had a lot of the Gordons. Nice chaps, most of them, very stoic about things generally. But terrible cowards about injections, I smiled, remembering one in particular. We had one, rather a crusty old thing, really, a piper from the 3rd Seaforths, who couldn't stand being stuck, especially not in the hip. He'd go for hours in the most awful discomfort before he let anyone near him with a needle, and even then he'd try to get us to give him the injection in his arm, though it's meant to be intramuscular. Laughed at the memory of Corporal Chisholm. He told me, if I'm going to lie on my face with my buttocks bared, I want the lass under me, not behind me with a hatpin. Frank smiled, but looked a trifle uneasy as he often did about my less delicate war stories. Don't worry, I assured him, seeing the look. I won't tell that one at tea in the senior common room. The smile lightened, and he came forward to stand behind me as I sat at my dressing table. He pressed a kiss on the top of my head. Don't worry, he said. The senior common room will love you, no matter what stories you tell. Your hair smells wonderful. Do you like it, then? His hand slid forward over my shoulders in answer, cupping my breasts in the thin nightdress. I could see his head above mine in the mirror, his chin resting on top of my head. "I like everything about you," he said huskily. "You look wonderful by candlelight, you know. Your eyes are like sherry in crystal and your skin glows like ivory. A candlelight witch you are. Perhaps I should disconnect the lamps permanently. Make it hard to read in bed," I said, my heart beginning to speed up. "I could think of better things to do in bed," he murmured. "Could you indeed?" I said, rising and turning to put my arms about his neck. "Like what?" And we'll leave our reading there for this week. The adventure. Definitely starting to get going now that we've got a ghost and a little bit of candlelight shenanigans happening. Hope you enjoyed that continued reading of Outlander. We'll get back to that in the coming weeks. Play safe, stay kinky, as if you had any choice in the matter. See you next week.
To support this space and to get access to TFD's exclusive guides to kink, spicy content and more, check out his Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefunnydom.